working at the school.
No, I was a substitute teacher. And a new program was being developed, and it was about 1968 by now. In the school, which was to integrate the school in the neighborhoods, and that was the beginning of integration, or the idea of integration.
What school were you substituting in? What was the name?
Well, substituting all over, you know, substitute all over. And I applied for the position, and it was called school community agent, which not too many people know about. And the program was brought to the Board of Education and was developed, and people were hired to go into the schools to bring the schools closer to the neighborhoods, to have the school as part of the community. It was a concept. Also to start preschool before kindergarten, thinking that integrated preschool would be an advantage in that children growing up together and learning about each other would be one step towards integration of the schools. And also giving those children from underprivileged homes a chance to be a little bit more educated as they go into kindergarten. This is pre-kindergarten. And I had two assignments. One was Lecce School up on the hill. And the other was Crescent School in Homewood Brushton. And we went around the neighborhood asking for children, young children, to come into the preschool, planning speakers, trying to get PTAs organized. Actually, it was like, you know, a social work type of thing. I guess that's what you call it.
Was it difficult?
Yeah, it was very difficult. It was really very difficult. It was very difficult because it was a concept that was not familiar. And it was also difficult in that the principals didn't know what to do with this new personnel that was coming into the schools. Anyhow, it was a two-year program. It only lasted 2 years. And that was it. I didn't want to really go on working. I didn't need to, and I didn't want to. And then you have to realize, too, in those days, women didn't work unless there was a financial need. Unless, of course, you're a professional woman. But then you also have to realize that there weren't all that many women going to college and getting degrees in medicine or dentistry. And I think there was, during Sam's class, there was only one woman dentist going to dental school.
Did he go to dental school here?
Pitt. Well, his family are an old, old Pittsburgh family. As a matter of fact, I think you have Dorothy on tape, and I'm sure we have Doris. Do you have Doris on tape?
I don't know. Was your father-in-law a dentist also?
No, my father-in-law was a jeweler. He was one of the first jewelers on the hill.
What about the percentage of women when you were in class?
There was already, you know, a number of women, not as much as today. And tuition was cheap then. I mean,
do you remember what the tuition was?
It was cheaper than it is today. And in families, if there was enough money to send a child to a university, they send the son. Girls went to teachers training, I guess it was. It was a 2-year course.
Normal school.
Normal school. And there were many schools that just offered a 2-year course for teaching. So it was a whole different philosophy as far as education was concerned. You know, today, unless you go on and get your doctorate, you just don't have a chance in a million of getting into any profession.
I think the tuition was around $200 a semester.
Was it that low?
No, it could be. It had to be more. Because when I went, it was $400 a semester.
Well, anyhow.
So when you stopped working, you went back into volunteer work?
Went back into volunteer work. Okay. And I enjoyed my volunteer work. I guess it was because of that, you know, my personality is, what would you call it?
People-oriented.
I'm people-oriented, okay. And I like to be with people. And I have leadership ability, and I wanted to use it. I was educated, and I wanted to use it. So I went into whatever was, whatever was going on. And let's see if there's anything in
what
here.
What about the Carnegie? You've been a docent
for
many years.
Yeah, I'll tell you that. Cultural arts, all right, docent. I just wanted to make sure that Jewish community. Women's B'nai B'rith Women's Council president. Oh, the Conference of Jewish Women. I knew there was one that I got to be. I became president of the Conference of Jewish Women.
What is that?
The Conference of Jewish Women is an organization that is made up of the presidents of all the Jewish women's organizations in the city. And once a month they have meetings to bring everybody together, and they talk about their own organizations, and it's a way of familiarizing the presidents of organizations about what other things are going on in the community, and also to work together to program and bring in speakers that maybe otherwise couldn't be afforded. And they also clear the calendar for events.
So do you join the conference just when you are president, or do you stay in the conference after your presidency is over?
Well, I'm past president, sure.
Is that, does that still exist?
Nancy Schumann is president. The presidents are drawn from past presidents of organizations. So, so then I became president of the conference. So you see where my, where I'm going here. I heard about an opportunity of becoming a docent, an art docent at the Carnegie Museum. And I applied and was accepted. A very, very prestigious position. And I have been there for 25 years. It opened up a whole new area of expertise for me. Because during my college years, even though I had taken subjects in the fine arts, there was never time to really study art.
What's
painting, sculpture.
What's the process of being a docent? What do you...
Well, when I went through it, well, you have to be interviewed first by a panel. And then if you're accepted, you go into a 2-year intensive program of study. Starting with, you won't believe it, Egypt. And the Renaissance, well, from Egypt we went to Greco-Roman, We had to study architecture, the art of the times, the sculpture, the culture, the reasons behind the works of art.
Did you docent it while you were taking this, or did you?
No, you cannot go out on the floor until you have completed this course of study. Two years.
2 years.
Wow.
Who teaches it?
I don't know who's doing it now. They've had.
They have different people from the different departments teach it, or one person.
When I was there, it was a. Her name was Dwyer. You don't need to put that down.
Mm-hmm.
Who has died.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there's a... what's their title? Coordinators, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good word. Coordinator of the docent program who, when they're a new class, starts, and they usually take in 25 in a class. And I think the last class was 2 years ago, or 3 years.
And how often do you go every day to this course, or how often do you go to classes?
Are you talking about
for the 2 year intensive course? Yeah. How?
No. It was twice a week.
Twice a week. Mm-hmm. All day.
Pretty much it ended up all day, but you had to write papers. You know, I mean, it was like going to college. I mean, I can't explain it except that it was really a very intense course. You know.
How many people were left in the corps
afterwards?
Afterwards, yeah.
Out of 25?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 20. Maybe less. You know, it depends.
And then after the two-year course?
Then we're allowed to go into the museum itself.
That's
and varies under supervision.
How large are the groups that you take around?
Well, you can't say. We do schools, you know. Now, schools can be anywhere from, well, we don't take more. Each docent doesn't take more than 12 kids. That's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The schools, you know, are budgeted to take their students to the museum. I think it's once a year. To the Museum of the Art Museum and the Museum of Natural History.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't do natural history.
How often do you volunteer?
Sometimes twice a week.
Is there a minimum amount of time that you have to put in?
Well, there's a minimum amount of hours. Yeah. It's not time. It's hours. Mondays we have lectures, and depending on what's going on, you know, if it's slow, it's slow. And if it's busy, which it is now, because what we're doing now is studying for the new installation that will start in April. And that is Falling Water and the Kaufmans. And Frank Lloyd Wright, the architect. So we've been going every Monday to, it's been wonderful because I didn't really know a lot about architecture. And the professor at Carnegie Mellon was a lecturer. Oh, it was fabulous. I mean, it was really fabulous. Now I look at buildings. You know, I know what Renaissance building looks like, and I know what, you know, Art Deco buildings look like. But I never had an in-depth experience in architecture. And now I look at buildings and I see something so different. I mean, it's fascinating, really fascinating. And then, of course, the international. Which brings artists from all over the world. And that is a busy time. See, that's why I can't give you time.
Yeah.
It's probably
See,
gotten
that's
busier.
A busy time.
It's probably gotten busier since 25 years ago. The Carnegie, is it a bigger museum now? Or how has it changed?
How has it changed? Well, let's see, the new section was built.
You're talking about the Museum of Art.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
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 That new section.
Yeah.
The architecture part.
Barnes was the architect. I guess in the 70s. When they enlarged.
Right.
It became a separate entity. The museum. We no longer do Egypt, because that's a whole new section under the Department of Natural History.
Oh, are you?
We don't do Indians anymore, because that's under the Department of Natural
History.
What
about dinosaurs?
Hmm?
Dinosaurs?
We don't do dinosaurs.
So, in other words, you're just in the
the
art building.
Just the art.
Well, don't they have docents for the natural history
sure.
building?
But they're paid.
Okay.
This is
okay.
a volunteer job.
And it's just
yeah.
for the art.
Yeah.
What other volunteer activities are Hillel? I also have them.
It was called B'nai B'rith Hillel at that time. And it was actually goes back to almost I don't remember how long. B'nai B'rith Hillel was brought to Pittsburgh through the efforts of women such as myself, my sister-in-law, and other concerned women, that there was a need for a Jewish presence on college campus. And that's how B'nai B'rith Hillel was started. And my husband, Sam, was chairman of the Hillel Council. And I've never been president of the Hillel Council. I couldn't possibly do all that anyhow. But I was active. I think here's a point that we need to remember, that Sam's interests and my interests were the same interests. In that when there was a convention, the B'nai B'rith Men's Convention, I would go with him. I mean, we traveled together. We had our same interests. We didn't go to meetings together necessarily, but I think this was kind of the glue. You know, just like some people golf together. We had organizations together. We were very tolerant of each other's organizations and activities. And it was good. I mean, there was nothing wrong with it. And when my children were growing up, they were in AZA. Marty, I'm Bobby. I think things were already coming down in East End. And they were presidents of BBG. So B'nai B'rith was a family organization at that time. I think that's important. It was a family organization. And that was good. And that was healthy. That no longer exists. Unfortunately, that no longer exists. Things changed. You know, East End changed. And, where do we want to go from here?
The Lev Society, you didn't mention that.
The Lev Society is for those people who have contributed to UJF. It tells you here over a period of time.
Well, you were active in that. Were you active in that Lev Society?
No, the Lev Society is fairly new.
Okay.
It's fairly new. No, but UJF has always been there.
Yeah.
It's a matter of contributing.
Oh, okay.
It's a matter of contributing. To. United Jewish Federation. 35 years, I think, or something like that. And then you can automatically can become a member of the Lev Society. So we have that, don't we?
Do you still belong to B'nai Israel?
Hmm?
Do you still belong to, B'nai Israel Club?
B'nai Israel no longer exists.
Right.
Most of the Jews moved to Squirrel Hill.
Did you move after the East End, or just to here, or did you?
No, no, Sam died. Mm-hmm. In 1981. I'm here 10 years, so that's mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's when I sold the house. My children were grown by then. Mm-hmm. Shelley is a psychotherapist, married to Edward, Dr. Edward Middleman, and they live in Dallas. Linda Shenza, lives here in Pittsburgh. She has two children, Craig and Jody. Shelley has three boys. Andrew Benton. Do you want these names? Andrew Benton and David. Andrew Benton and David now have children. They're married. Benton is a doctor, and he lives in Dallas, Texas. And he now has two babies, a little boy, Jacob. Is it Joseph? It's Joseph. And a little girl. Andrew lives in Houston, Texas, and he has two little girls, Kelly and Shayna. And David lives in Houston, Texas, and he has a little boy and a little girl. Mm. Marty lives in Baltimore. He's a physician. And he has two children, Jessica and Gregory. They are active in their communities. They're good people.
I wanted to ask you, just so many things went through with Pittsburgh. What was the certain events, like the Depression in Pittsburgh? Do you recall any?
Well, the Depression was 1930.
Yeah.
So yeah. I wasn't living in Pittsburgh at the time.
Were you going in Altoona?
I was in Altoona at the time.
What was
of course,
it
was
what
a terrible
was it like?
Town.
It was anything
I'll tell you a story
okay.
about the Depression that is very, very clear in my mind. My father had a store, a meat market, and what was the working class neighborhood in Altoona where the, it was really an Italian Catholic neighborhood, and the men worked in the railroad. I mean, that was a big industry, the railroad. And the banks closed. Depression. And the bank, which was across the street from my father's store, closed. And people had just gotten their checks and had deposited them in the bank. And the next day, the bank closed. And they couldn't get in to get their money. And, it makes me... God. And people just, well, I was a kid, but I can remember them. And people just stood in front of the bank crying because they had no money. I mean, it was so awful. Don't forget, we're not talking about street people. We're talking about hardworking people who depended from check to check.
What year was this, around 30? 30?
Oh, I guess it's 1931, 32, around the 30s. And, eventually, of course, they did. But anyhow.
How long were the
banks
closed?
My dad had some wonderful customers. Wonderful customers.
How long were the banks closed?
Well, I think they weren't closed maybe 5 days, 6 days. I don't remember. I mean, but, hey, listen. if you're depending on that check.
And it must have been hard for your father because he wasn't getting
married. No, they can, you know, and they would come in and they'd say, hey, just don't have any money. He said, don't worry. You'll pay me when you have it. And they did. They did, because it was a neighborhood. My God, we don't have neighborhoods, yeah. You know. You can't do that if you walk into Giant Eagle, you know. We were talking neighborhoods. I just wish I could impress on you both the neighborhood feeling. The neighborhood feeling. The feeling of, you know that store. You know that man in the store.
Was it more in Altoona than in Pittsburgh? When you moved to Pittsburgh and your children were growing up, that was a neighborhood also.
Well, it was a neighborhood, and we, big stores were already, you know, I think A&P already, you know.
But did you still have the same kind of neighborhood feeling?
Yeah, I thought so, and that's why we moved to East End or to Highland Avenue. Sam's mother and father lived on Callahill Street. Sister Dorothy lived on Callahill Street. This is our joke. This is our story, a family story. His sister Bernice lived on Callahill Street. Mervyn and Doris, when they got married, built their house. Well, you have to picture that. Okay, this is Callahill Street. So, Renee and Harold, your cousins. Callahill Street down here. There was Sam's mother and father and Bernice and Dorothy and his. It was a duplex. They then gave that duplex to Dorothy and his, and they built another duplex on Negley, right around the corner, near the park. And Bernice lived upstairs. She was married. So you come up Kelly, and then there's Elgin that goes this way, and Renee and Harold have their house here. You come up, and then you're on Highland Avenue. If you go this way, Mervyn and Doris lived up here. If you go down this way, we lived here. So we had within this area, it was almost like a compound of Binstock.
Did you get together for all the holidays?
Yeah, we got together for all the holidays, of course. We still do.
You still do?
We still do. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Sam's family, yeah. So we had this whole, I mean, it was ours, you know?
Sure.
It was ours, and we did a little story on it, you know, about how you could walk. I mean, if you walked and got tired, you could always stop at a Binstock's. And we were down here. Anyhow, that was the story.
Or your children could.
Hmm?
Or your children could stop at a Binstock's.
Yeah, you know, it was like it was kind of like a circle, you know, and we all lived there. We just all lived there.
What about other events that happened, like Prohibition? Do you remember any stories?
Prohibition was in the
20s. Too early for you.
Not that old. In the 20s. No, but that I do remember. And also that, of course, these are, you know, this is our town. I was a child at the time. And we had this other big store that I told you about on 26th Street, which was the Furnace Avenue. And people would come in and the same thing, you know, we can't pay you today. And my mother, there were big, you don't need to put all this in. There were big tubs. Butter came in big tubs.
This is interesting, though.
Yeah.
Can you picture the store? It was a big store, you know, meat and groceries. But it was family, you know, family oriented. And big tubs of peanut butter. And they would come, kids would come in with their parents, you know, to buy whatever it was. And my mother would always take crackers. And she would say, now, she would put peanut butter on a cracker. And she knew those kids were hungry. And she said, oh, you've got to taste this peanut. You've got to taste this peanut butter. People were
kinder. I don't know what it was. Why were people kinder? You know.
Less hurried.
They were just kinder. People depended on each other then. Now, people are more independent.
I'm not trying to idealize this.
Yeah.
I'm not idealizing, and I'm not saying that everybody was wonderful because...
Do you think that it was because people depended on one another more?
No, I think it was because you got to know people better. I think you just got to know people better. You know, there was our big store, and then across the street was Sheetz's. Sheetz's, which now is in Pittsburgh. That started Sheetz's ice cream.
And, you know, did you go into
Sheetz's and they say, oh, hi, Tessie.
Yeah.
You know.
Also, people
And they called me Miss Tessie, the people who came into, here comes Miss Tessie.
Tessie, I don't remember, did that house have a front porch on it? Did you sit on the front porch?
Side. We had a side porch.
But you sat so that you saw your neighbors.
On the side porch. We were on the corner.
Right.